annoyed or in danger. A brave man, physically and mentally. A great leader. Honest as the day is long, fair, perceptive. Reacher's role model during his vital formative years. His mentor and his sponsor. His protector. He had gone way out on a limb and promoted him twice in an 18-month span, which made Reacher the youngest peacetime major anybody could remember. Then he had spread his blunt hands wide and smiled and disclaimed any credit for his ensuing successes. "I'm very sorry, Jody," he said again. She nodded silently. "I can't believe it," he said. "I can't take it in. I saw him less than a year ago. He was in good shape then. He got sick?" She nodded again, still silent. "But he was always so tough," he said. She nodded sadly. "He was, wasn't he? Always so tough. And not old," he said. 64. "So what happened?" "His heart," she said. "It got him in the end. Remember how he always liked to pretend he didn't have one?" Reacher shook his head. "Biggest heart you ever saw?" "I found that out," she said. "When Mom died, we were best friends for 10 years. I loved him."
"I loved him too," Reacher said. "Like he was my dad, not yours."
She nodded again. "He still talked about you all the time." Reacher looked away. Stared out at the unfocused shape of the West Point buildings, gray in the haze. He was numb. He was in that age zone where people he knew died. His father was dead. His mother was dead. His brother was dead. Now the nearest thing to a substitute relative was dead, too. "He had a heart attack 6 months ago," Jody said. Her eyes clouded and she hooked her long, straight hair behind her ear. "He sort of recovered for a spell, looked pretty good. But really, he was failing fast. They were considering a bypass, but he took a turn for the worse and went down too quickly. He wouldn't have survived the surgery."
"I'm very sorry," he said for the third time.
She turned alongside him and threaded her arm through his.
"Don't be," she said.
"He was always a very contented guy. Better for him to go fast. I couldn't see him being happy lingering on." Reacher had a flash in his mind of the old Garber bustling and raging. A fireball of energy, and he understood how desperate it would have made him to become an invalid. Understood, too, how that overloaded old heart had finally given up the struggle. He nodded unhappily.
"Come and meet some people," Jody said. "Maybe you know some of them."
"I'm not dressed for this," he said. "I feel bad. I should go."
"Doesn't matter," she said. "You think Dad would care?"
He saw Garber in his old creased khaki and his battered hat. He was the worst-dressed officer in the U.S. Army. All 13 years Reacher had served under him. He smiled briefly.
"I guess he wouldn't mind," he said.
She walked him onto the lawn. There were maybe 6 people out of the 100 he recognized. A couple of the guys in uniform were familiar. A handful in suits were men he'd worked with here and there in another lifetime. He shook hands with dozens of people and tried to listen to the names, but they went in one ear and out the other. Then the quiet chatter and the eating and the drinking started up again. The crowd closed around him, and the sensation of his untidy arrival was smoothed over and forgotten. Jody still had hold of his arm. Her hand was cool on his skin.
"I'm looking for somebody," he said. "That's why I'm here, really."
"I know," she said. "Mrs. Jacob, right?"
He nodded.
"Is she here?" he asked.
"I'm Mrs. Jacob," she said.
The 2 guys in the black Tahoe backed it out of the line of cars, out from under the power lines so the car phone would work without interference. The driver dialed a number and the ringtone filled the quiet vehicle. Then the call was answered 60 miles south and 88 floors up.
"Problems, boss," the driver said. "There's some sort of a wake going on here, a funeral or something. Must be 100 people milling around. We got no chance of grabbing this Mrs. Jacob. We can't even tell which one she is. There are dozens of women here. She could be any of them."
The speaker relayed a grunt from Hobie.
"And?"
"The guy from the bar down in the Keys? He just showed up here in a damn taxi."
Got here about 10 minutes after we did, strolled right in. The speaker crackled. No discernible reply. So what do we do? The driver asked.
Stick with it, Hobie's voice said. Maybe hide the vehicle and lay out someplace. Wait until everybody leaves. It's her house, as far as I can tell. Maybe the family home or a weekend place, so everybody else will leave, and she'll be the one who stays. Don't you come back here without her, okay?
What about the big guy?
If he leaves, let him go. If he doesn't, waste him. But bring me this Jacob woman.
You're Mrs. Jacob? Reacher asked. Jody Garber nodded. Am, was, she said. I'm divorced, but I keep the name for work.
Who was he?
She shrugged. A lawyer, like me. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
How long?
3 years, beginning to end. We met at law school, got married when we got jobs. I stayed on Wall Street, but he went to a firm in D.C. a couple of years ago. The marriage didn't go with him, just kind of petered out. The papers came through last fall. I could hardly remember who he was. Just a name, Alan Jacob.
Reacher stood in the sunny yard and looked at her. He realized he was upset that she had been married. She had been a skinny kid, but totally gorgeous at 15. Self-confident and innocent, and a little shy about it all at the same time. He had watched the battle between her shyness and her curiosity, as she sat and worked up the courage to talk to him about death and life and good and evil. Then she would fidget and tuck her bony knees up under her and work the conversation around to love and sex and men and women. Then she would blush and disappear. He would be left alone, icy inside, captivated by her and angry at himself for it. Days later, he would see her somewhere around the base, still blushing furiously. And now, 15 years later, she was a grown woman, college and law school, married and divorced, beautiful and composed and elegant, standing there in her dead father's yard with her arm linked through his.
Are you married? She asked him.
He shook his head. No.
But are you happy?
I'm always happy, he said. Always was, always will be.
Doing what?
He shrugged.
Nothing much, he said.
He glanced over the top of her head and scanned the faces in the crowd. Subdued, busy people. Substantial lives, big careers, all of them moving steadily from A to Z.
He looked at them and wondered if they were the fools, or if he was. He recalled the expression on Costello's face.
I was just in the Keys, he said, digging swimming pools with a shovel.
Her face didn't change. She tried to squeeze his forearm with her hand, but her hand was too small and his arm was too big. It came out as a gentle pressure from her palm.
Costello find you down there? She asked.
He didn't find me to invite me to a funeral, he thought. We need to talk about Costello, he said.
He's good, isn't he?
Not good enough, he thought. She moved away to circulate through the crowd. People were waiting to offer their second layer condolences. They were getting loose from the wine, and the buzz of talk was getting louder and more sentimental. Reacher drifted over to a patio where a long table with a white cloth held food. He loaded a paper plate with cold chicken and rice and took a glass of water. There was an ancient patio furniture set ignored by the others because it was all spotted with little gray-green botanical droppings from the trees. The sun umbrella was stiff and faded white. Reacher ducked under it and sat quietly in a dirty chair on his own. He watched the crowd as he ate. People were reluctant to leave. The affection for old Leon Garber was palpable. A guy like that generates affection in others, maybe too much to express to his face. So it has to all come out later. Jody was moving through the crowd, nodding, clasping hands, smiling sadly. Everybody had a tale to tell her, an anecdote about witnessing Garber's heart of gold peeping out from under his gruff and irascible exterior. He could add a few stories, but he wouldn't, because Jody didn't need it explained to her that her father had been one of the good guys. She knew. She was moving with the serenity of a person who had loved the old guy all her life and had been loved back. There was nothing she had neglected to tell him. Nothing he had neglected to tell her. People live, and then they die. And as long as they do both things properly, there's nothing much to regret.
They found a place on the same road that was obviously a weekend cottage, closed up tight and unoccupied. They backed the Tahoe around behind the garage where it was hidden from the street, but ready for pursuit. They took the 9mm out of the glove box and stowed them in their jacket pockets, walked back down to the road and ducked into the undergrowth. It was hard going. They were just 60 miles north of Manhattan, but they might as well have been in the jungles of Borneo. There were ragged vines tangled everywhere, grabbing at them, tripping them, whipping their faces and hands. The trees were second-growth native broadleafs, growing wild, basically weeds, and their branches came out of them at crazy low angles. They took to walking backward, forcing their way through. When they got level with the Garber driveway, they were panting and gasping and smeared with moss and green pollen dust. They pushed through onto the property and found a depression in the ground where they were concealed. They ducked left and right to get a view of the pathway leading up from the backyard. People were heading out, getting ready to leave. It was becoming obvious which one was Mrs. Jacob. If Hobie was right, and this was her place, then she was the thin blonde shaking hands and saying goodbye like all these departing people had been her guests. They were leaving, she was staying. She was Mrs. Jacob. They watched her, the center of attention, smiling bravely, embracing, waving. People filed up the driveway, ones and twos, then larger groups. Cars were starting. Blue exhaust haze was drifting. They could hear the hiss and groan of power steering as people eased out of the tight line. The rub of tires on pavement. The burble of motors accelerating away down the road. This was going to be easy. Pretty soon, she was going to be standing there all by herself, all choked up and sad. Then she was going to get a couple of extra visitors. Maybe she would see them coming and take them for a couple of mourners arriving late. After all, they were dressed in dark suits and ties. What fits in Manhattan's financial district looks just about right for a funeral. Reacher followed the last two guests up the cement steps and out of the yard. One was a colonel, and the other was a two-star general, both in immaculate dress uniform. It was what he had expected, a place with free food and drink. The soldiers will always be the last to leave. He didn't know the colonel, but he thought he vaguely recognized the general. He thought the general recognized him, too, but neither of them pursued it. No desire on either part to get into long and complicated, "So what are you doing now?" explanations. The brass shook hands quite formally with Jody, and then they snapped to attention and saluted. Crisp parade ground moves, gleaming boots smashing into the blacktop, eyes rigidly to the front. 1,000-yard stares, all quite bizarre, in the green stillness of a suburban driveway. They got into the last car left on the garage apron, one of the flat green sedans parked nearest to the house. First to arrive, last to leave. Peacetime, no Cold War, nothing to do all day. It was why Reacher had been happy when they cut him loose, and as he watched the green car turn and head out, he knew he was right to be happy. Jody stepped sideways to him and linked her arm through his again. "So," she said quietly, "that's that." Then there was just building silence as the noise from the green car faded and died along the road. "Where's he buried?" Reacher asked. "The town cemetery," she said. "He could have chosen Arlington, of course, but he didn't want that. You want to go up there?" He shook his head. "No, I don't do stuff like that. Makes no difference to him now, does it? He knew I'll miss him because I told him so a long time ago." She nodded, held his arm. "We need to talk about Costello," he said again.
"Why?"
she asked.
"He gave you the message, right?"
He shook his head. "No, he found me, but I was wary. I said I wasn't Jack Reacher." She looked up at him, astonished.
"But why?"
He shrugged. "Habit, I guess. I don't go around looking for involvement. I didn't recognize the name Jacob, so I just ignored him. I was happy living quiet down there." She was still looking at him.
"I guess I should have used Garber," she said. "It was Dad's business anyway, not mine. But I did it through the firm, and I never even thought about it. You'd have listened to him if he'd said Garber, right?"
"Of course," he said.
"And you needn't have worried, because it was no kind of a big deal." Can we go inside? He asked. She was surprised again.
Why?
Because it was some kind of a very big deal. They saw her lead him in through the front door. She pulled the screen and he held it while she turned the knob and opened up. Some kind of a big front door, dull brown wood. They went inside and the door closed behind them. 10 seconds later, a dim light came on in a window, way off to the left. Some kind of a sitting room or den, they guessed. So shaded by the runaway plantings outside that it needed lights on even in the middle of the day. They crouched in their damp hollow and waited. Insects were drifting through the sunbeams all around them. They glanced at each other and listened hard. No sound. They pushed through to the driveway. Ran crouched to the corner of the garage. Pressed up against the siding and slid around to the front. Across the front toward the house. They went into their jackets for the pistols. Held them pointed at the ground and went one at a time for the front porch. They regrouped and eased slowly over the old timbers. Ended up squatting on the floor, backs pressed against the house. One on either side of the front door, pistols out and ready. She'd gone in this way. She'd come back out. Just a matter of time.
Somebody killed him?
Jody repeated. And his secretary, probably, Reacher said.
I don't believe it,
she said.
Why?
She had led him through a dark hallway to a small den in the far corner of the house. A tiny window and dark wood paneling and heavy brown leather furniture made it gloomy, so she switched on a desk lamp, which changed it into a cozy man space like the pre-war bars Reacher had seen in Europe. There were shelves of books, cheap editions bought by subscription decades ago, and curled, faded photographs thumbtacked to the front edges of the shelves. There was a plain desk, the sort of place where an old, underemployed man does his bills and taxes in imitation of how he used to work when he had a job.
I don't know why, Reacher said. I don't know anything. I don't even know why you sent him looking for me.
Dad wanted you, she said. He never really told me why. I was busy. I had a trial. Complex thing lasted months. I was preoccupied. All I know is, after he got sick, he was going to the cardiologist, right? He met somebody there and got involved with something. He was worried about it. Seemed to me he felt he was under some kind of a big obligation. Then later, when he got worse, he knew he would have to drop it, and he started saying he should find you and let you take a look at it because you were a person who could maybe do something about it. He was getting all agitated, which was really not a good idea, so I said I'd get Costello to locate you. We use him all the time at the firm, and it felt like the least I should do.
It made some kind of sense, but Reacher's first thought was, why me?
He could see Garber's problem. In the middle of something, health failing, unwilling to abandon an obligation, needing help. But a guy like Garber could get help anywhere. The Manhattan Yellow Pages were full of investigators. And if it was something too arcane or too personal for a city investigator, then all he had to do was pick up the phone and a dozen of his friends from the military police would come running. 2 dozen. 100. All of them willing and anxious to repay his many kindnesses and favors that stretched right back through their whole careers. So Reacher was sitting there asking himself, why me in particular? Who was the person he met at the cardiologist? She shrugged unhappily.
I don't know. I was preoccupied. We never really went into it.
Did Costello come up here, discuss it directly with him?
She nodded.
I called him and told him we'd pay him through the firm, but he was to come here and get the details. He called me back a day or two later, said he'd discussed it with Dad, and it all boiled down to finding you. He wanted me to retain him officially on paper because it could get expensive, so naturally I did that because I didn't want Dad worrying about the cost or anything.
Which is why he told me his client was Mrs. Jacob, Reacher said, not Leon Garber. Which is why I ignored him. Which is how I got him killed.
She shook her head and looked at him sharply, like he was some kind of a new associate who had just done a piece of sloppy drafting. It took him by surprise. He was still thinking of her as a 15-year-old girl, not a 30-year-old lawyer who spent her time getting preoccupied with long and complex trials.
Non sequitur, she said. It's clear what happened, right? Dad told Costello the story. Costello tried some kind of a shortcut before he went looking for you. whereby he turned over the wrong stone and got somebody alerted. That somebody killed him to find out who was looking and why. Makes no difference if you'd played ball right away. They'd still have gotten to Costello to ask him exactly who put him on the trail. So, it's me who got him killed, ultimately.
Reacher shook his head. It was Leon, through you. She shook her head in turn.
It was the person at the cardiology clinic. Him through Dad, through me.
I need to find that person, he said.
Does it matter now?
I think it does, he said. If Leon was worried about something, then I'm worried about it too. That's how it worked for us.
Jody nodded quietly, stood up quickly and stepped over to the bookshelves, pincered her fingernails and levered the thumbtack out of one of the photographs, looked hard at it, and then passed it across to him. Remember that? She asked.
The photograph must have been 15 years old, the colors fading to pale pastels the way old Kodak does with age and sunlight. It had the harsh, bright sky of Manila above a dirt yard. Leon Garber was on the left, about 50, dressed in creased olive fatigues. Reacher himself was on the right, 24 years old, a lieutenant, a foot taller than Garber, smiling with all the blazing vigor of youth. Between the two of them was Jody, 15, in a sundress, one bare arm around her father's shoulders, the other around Reacher's waist. She was squinting in the sun, smiling, leaning toward Reacher like she was hugging his waist with all the strength in her skinny brown frame.
Remember? He just bought the Nikon and the PX? With the self-timer? Borrowed a tripod and couldn't wait to try it out?
Reacher nodded. He remembered. He remembered the smell of her hair that day, in the hot Pacific sun. Clean, young hair. He remembered the feel of her body against his. He remembered the feel of her long, thin arm around his waist. He remembered screaming at himself, "Hold on, pal. She's only 15, and she's your CO's daughter."
He called that his family picture, she said. Always did.
He nodded again. That's why. That's how it worked for us. She gazed at the photograph for a long moment, something in her face. And there's the secretary, he said to her. They'll have asked her who the client was. She'll have told them. And even if she didn't, they'll find out anyway. Took me 30 seconds in one phone call. So now they're going to come looking for you to ask you who's behind all of this.
She looked blank and put the old photograph on the desk. But I don't know who.
You think they're going to believe that?
She nodded vaguely and glanced toward the window. Okay, so what do I do?
You get out of here, he said. That's for damn sure. Too lonely, too isolated. You got a place in the city?
Sure, she said. A loft on Lower Broadway.
You got a car here?
She nodded. Sure, in the garage. But I was going to stay here tonight. I've got to find his will, do the paperwork, close things down. I was going to leave tomorrow morning early.
Do all that stuff now, he said. As fast as you can and get out. I mean it, Jody. Whoever these people are, they're not playing games. The look on his face told her more than words. She nodded quickly and stood up.
Okay, the desk. You can give me a hand.
From his high school ROTC until his ill health demobilization, Leon Garber had done almost 50 years of military service of one sort or another. It showed right there in his desk. The upper drawers contained pens and pencils and rulers, all in neat rows. The lower drawers were double height, with concertina files hanging on neat rods. Each was labeled in careful handwriting. Taxes, phone, electricity, heating oil, yard work, appliance warranties. There was a label with newer handwriting in a different color. Last Will and Testament. Jody flicked through the files and ended up lifting the whole concertina out of each drawer. Reacher found a battered leather suitcase in the den closet, and they loaded the concertina straight into it. Forced the lid down tight and snapped it shut. Reacher picked up the old photograph from the desk and looked at it again. Did you resent it? He asked. The way he thought about me, family. She paused in the doorway and nodded.
I resented it like crazy, she said. And one day I'll tell you exactly why.
He just looked at her and she turned and disappeared down the hallway.
I'll get my things, she called. 5 minutes, okay?
He stepped over to the bookshelf and tacked the old picture back in its original position. Then he snapped the light off and carried the suitcase out of the room. Stood in the quiet hallway and looked around. It was a pleasant house. It had been expanded in size at some stage in its history. That was clear. There was a central core of rooms that made some kind of sense in terms of layout. And then there were more rooms off the dog-legged hallway he was standing in. They branched out from arbitrary little inner lobbies. Too small to be called a warren, too big to be predictable. He wandered through to the living room. The windows overlooked the yard and the river, with the West Point buildings visible at an angle from the fireplace end. The air was still and smelled of old polish. The decor was faded and had been plain to start with. Neutral wood floors, cream walls, heavy furniture. An ancient TV, no video. Books, pictures, more photographs, nothing matched. It was an undesigned place, evolved, comfortable. It had been lived in. Garber must have bought it 30 years ago, probably when Jody's mother got pregnant. It was a common move. Married officers with a family often bought a place, often near their first service base or near some other location they imagined was going to be central to their lives, like West Point. They bought the place and usually left it empty while they lived overseas. The point was to have an anchor, somewhere identifiable they knew they would come back to when it was all over. Or somewhere their families could live if the overseas posting was unsuitable or if their children's education demanded consistency. Reacher's parents had not taken that route. They had never bought a place. Reacher had never lived in a house. Grim service bungalows and army bunkhouses were where he had lived, and since then, cheap motels. And he was pretty sure he never wanted anything different. He was pretty sure he didn't want to live in a house. The desire just passed him by. The necessary involvement intimidated him. It was a physical weight, exactly like the suitcase in his hand. The bills, the property taxes, the insurance, the warranties, the repairs, the maintenance, the decisions. New roof or new stove, carpeting or rugs, the budgets, the yard work. He stepped over and looked out of the window at the lawn. Yard work summed up the whole futile procedure. First, you spend a lot of time and money making the grass grow just so you can spend a lot of time and money cutting it down again a little while later. You curse about it getting too long, and then you worry about it staying too short, and you sprinkle expensive water on it all summer and expensive chemicals all fall. Crazy. But if any house could change his mind, maybe Garber's house might do it. It was so casual, so undemanding. It looked like it had prospered on benign neglect. He could just about imagine living in it, and the view was powerful. The wide Hudson rolling by, reassuring and physical. That old river was going to keep on rolling by, whatever anybody did about the houses and the yards that dotted its banks. "Okay, I'm ready, I guess," Jody called. She appeared in the living room doorway. She was carrying a leather garment bag, and she had changed out of her black funeral suit. Now she was in a pair of faded Levi's and a powder blue sweatshirt with a small logo Reacher couldn't decipher. She had brushed her hair, and the static had kicked a couple of strands outward. She was smoothing them back with her hand, hooking them behind her ear. The powder blue shirt picked up her eyes and emphasized the pale honey of her skin. The last 15 years had done her no harm at all. They walked through to the kitchen and bolted the door to the yard, turned off all the appliances they could see, and screwed the faucets tight shut. Came back out into the hallway and opened the front door. Chapter 5. Reacher was first out through the door for a number of reasons. Normally, he might have let Jody go out ahead of him, because his generation still carried with it the last vestiges of American good manners. But he had learned to be wary about displaying chivalry until he knew exactly how the woman he was with was going to react. And it was her house, not his, which altered the dynamic anyway, and she would need to use the key to lock the door behind them. So for all those reasons, he was the first person to step out to the porch. And so he was the first person the two guys saw. "Waste the big guy and bring me Mrs. Jacob," Hobie had told them. The guy on the left went for a snapshot from a sitting position. He was tensed up and ready, so it took his brain a lot less than a second to process what his optic nerve was feeding it.
He felt the front door open, he saw the screen swing out, and he saw somebody stepping onto the porch. He saw it was the big guy coming first, and he fired. The guy on the right was in a dumb position. The screen creaked open right in his face. In itself, it was no kind of an obstacle, because tight nylon gauze designed to stop insects is not going to do a lot about stopping bullets. But he was a right-handed guy, and the frame of the screen was moving on a direct collision course with his gun hand as it swung around into position. That made him hesitate fractionally, and then scramble up and forward around the arc of the frame. He grabbed it backhanded with his left, and pulled it into his body and folded himself around it with his right hand, swinging up and into position. By then, Reacher was operating unconsciously and instinctively. He was nearly 39 years old, and his memory stretched back through maybe 35 of those years to the dimmest early fragments of his childhood. And that memory was filled with absolutely nothing except military service. His father's, his friend's father's, his own, his friend's. He had never known stability. He had never completed a year in the same school. He had never worked 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. He had never counted on anything at all except surprise and unpredictability. There was a portion of his brain developed way out of all proportion, like a grotesquely overtrained muscle, which made it seem to him entirely reasonable that he should step out of a door in a quiet New York suburban town and glance down at two men he had last seen 2,000 miles away in the Keys, crouching and swinging 9mm pistols up in his direction. No shock, no surprise, no gasping, freezing fear or panic, no pausing, no hesitation, no inhibitions. Just instant reaction to a purely mechanical problem laid out in front of him, like a geometric diagram involving time and space and angles, and hard bullets, and soft flesh. The heavy suitcase was in his left hand, swinging forward as he labored with it over the threshold. He did two things at once. First, he kept the swing going, using all the new strength in his left shoulder to kick the case onward and outward. Second, he windmilled his right arm backward and shoved Jody in the chest, smashing her back inside the hallway. She staggered back a step, and the moving suitcase caught the first bullet. Reacher felt it kick in his hand. He jerked it right to the end of its swing, leaning out into the porch like a hesitant diver over a cold pool, and it hit the left-hand guy a glancing blow in the face. He was half up and half down, crouching, unstable, and the blow from the case rolled him over and backward and out of the picture. But Reacher didn't see him go down, because his eyes were already on the other guy looping around the screen with his gun about 15 degrees away from ready. Reacher used the momentum of the swinging suitcase to hurl himself forward. He let the handle pull out through his hooked fingertips and flip him into a dive with his right arm accelerating back past him straight out across the porch. The gun swung around and smacked him flat on his chest. He heard it fire and felt the muzzle blast sear his skin. The bullet launched sideways under his raised left arm and hit the distant garage about the same time his right elbow hit the guy in the face. An elbow moving fast, ahead of 250 pounds of diving body weight, does a lot of damage. It glanced off the frame of the screen and caught the guy in the chin. The shock wave went back and up through the hinge of the jaw, which is a sturdy enough joint that the force was carried undiminished up into the guy's brain. Reacher could tell from the rubbery way he fell across his back that he was out for a spell. Then the screen door was creaking shut against its spring, and the left-hand guy was scrabbling sideways across the porch floorboards for his gun, which was skittering away from him. Jody was framed in the doorway, bent double, hands clasped to her chest, gasping for breath. The old suitcase was toppling end over end out onto the front lawn. Jody was the problem. He was separated from her by about 8 feet, and the left-hand guy was between the two of them. If he grabbed the skittering gun and lined it up to his right, he would be lined up on her. Reacher heaved the unconscious guy out of the way and threw himself at the door. Batted the screen back and fell inside. Dragged Jody a yard into the hallway and slammed the door shut. It kicked and banged 3 times as the guy fired after him and dust and wood splinters blasted out into the air. He clicked the lock and pulled Jody across the floor to the kitchen. "Can we get to the garage?"
"Through the breezeway," she gasped.
It was June,
so the storm windows were down and the breezeway was nothing but a wide passage with floor-to-ceiling screens on both sides. The left-hand guy was using an M9 Beretta, which would have started the day with 15 rounds in the box. He'd fired 4, 1 into the suitcase and 3 into the door, 11 left, which was not a comforting thought when all that stood between you and them was a few square yards of nylon mesh. Car keys? She fumbled them out of her bag. He took them and closed them into his fist. The kitchen door had a glass panel with a view straight through the breezeway to an identical door exactly opposite, which led into the garage. Is that door locked? She nodded breathlessly.
The green one. Green for garage.
He looked at the bunch of keys. There was an old Yale, dotted with a smear of green paint. He eased the kitchen door open and knelt and eased his head out lower than would be expected. He craned around both ways. No sign of the guy waiting outside. Then he selected the green key and held it pointed out in front of him like a tiny lance. Pushed to his feet and sprinted. Checked and slammed the key into the hole and turned it and yanked it back out. Pushed the door open and waved Jody across after him. She fell into the garage and he slammed the door behind her, locked it and listened. No sound. The garage was a large dark space, open rafters, open framing, smelling of old motor oil and creosote. It was full of garage things, mowers and hoses and lawn chairs, but they were all old things, the belongings of a man who stopped buying new gizmos 20 years ago. So the main doors were just manual rollers that ran upward in curving metal tracks. No mechanism. No electric opener. The floor was smooth poured concrete, aged and swept to a shine. Jody's car was a new Oldsmobile Bravada, dark green, gold accents. It was crouched there in the dark, nose in to the back wall. Badges on the tailgate boasting about four-wheel drive and a V6 engine. The four-wheel drive would be useful, but how fast that V6 started would be crucial.
"Get in the back," he whispered. "Down on the floor, okay?"
She crawled in head first and lay down across the transmission hump. He crossed the garage and found the key to the door out to the yard, opened it up, and peered out and listened. No movement, no sound. Then he came back to the car and slid the key in and switched on the ignition so he could rack the electric seat all the way back to the end of its runners.
"I'll be there in a minute," he whispered.
Garber's tool area was as tidy as his desk had been. There was an 8x4 pegboard with a full set of household tools neatly arranged on it. Reacher selected a heavy carpenter's hammer and lifted it down. Stepped out of the door to the yard and threw the hammer overarm diagonally right over the house to send it crashing into the undergrowth he had seen at the front. He counted to 5 to give the guy time to hear it and react to it and run toward it from wherever he was currently hiding. Then he ducked back inside to the car, stood alongside the open door and turned the key arm's length, fired it up. The engine started instantly. He dodged backward and flung the roller door up. It crashed along its metal track. He threw himself into the driver's seat and smashed the selector into reverse and stamped on the pedal. All 4 tires howled and then bit on the smooth concrete and the vehicle shot backward out of the garage. Reacher glimpsed the guy with the Beretta, way off to his left on the front lawn, spinning to look at them. He accelerated all the way up the driveway and lurched backward into the road, braked fiercely, and spun the wheel and found drive and took off in a haze of blue tire smoke. He accelerated hard for 50 yards and then lifted off the gas. Coasted to a gentle stop just beyond the neighbor's driveway. Selected reverse again and idled backward into it and down into the plantings. Straightened up and killed the motor. Behind him, Jody struggled up off the floor and stared.
"Hell are we doing here?" she said,
waiting.
"For what?"
"For them to get out of there." She gasped halfway between outrage and astonishment.
"We're not waiting, Reacher. We're going straight to the police with this."
He turned the key again to give him power to operate the window. Buzzed it all the way down so he could listen to the sounds outside. "I can't go to the police with this," he said, not looking at her.
"Why the hell can't you?"
"Because they'll start looking at me for Costello."
"You didn't kill Costello."
"You think they'll be ready and willing to believe that?"
"They'll have to believe it because it wasn't you, simple as that."
"Could take them time to find somebody looks better for it." She paused.
"So what are you saying?" I'm saying it's all around advantageous I stay away from the police. She shook her head. He saw it in the mirror.
No, Reacher, we need the police for this.
He kept his eyes on hers in the mirror. Remember what Leon used to say? He used to say, hell, I am the police.
Well, he was and you were, but that was a long time ago.
Not so long ago for either of us. She went quiet, sat forward, leaned toward him.
You don't want to go to the police, right? That's it, isn't it? Not that you can't, you just damn well don't want to.
He half turned in the driver's seat so he could look straight at her. He saw her eyes drop to the burn on his shirt. There was a long teardrop shape there, a black sooty stain, gunpowder particles tattooed into the cotton. He undid the buttons and pulled the shirt open, squinted down. The same teardrop shape was burned into his skin. The hairs frizzed and curled, a blister already puffing up, getting red and angry. He licked his thumb and pressed it on the blister and grimaced. They mess with me? They answer to me. She stared at him.
You're totally unbelievable, you know that? You're just as bad as my father was. We should go to the police, Reacher.
Can't do it, he said. They'll throw me in jail.
We should,
she said again. But she said it weakly. He shook his head and said nothing back, watched her closely. She was a lawyer, but she was also Leon's daughter, and she knew how things worked outside in the real world. She was quiet for a long spell, and then she shrugged helplessly and put her hand on her breastbone like it was tender. You okay? He asked her.
You hit me kind of hard, she said.
I could rub it better, he thought.
Who were those guys?
She asked. The two who killed Costello, he said. She nodded, then she sighed. Her blue eyes glanced left and right.
So where are we going?
He relaxed, then he smiled. Where's the last place they'll look for us? She shrugged, took her hand off her chest and used it to smooth her hair.
Manhattan? She said.
The house, he said. They saw us run. They won't expect us to double back.
You're crazy, you know that?
We need the suitcase. Leon might have made notes. She shook her head, dazed. And we need to close the place up again. We can't leave the garage open. It'll end up full of raccoons. Whole families of the bastards. Then he held up his hand, put his finger to his lips. There was the sound of a motor starting up. Maybe a big V8, maybe 200 yards away. There was the rattle of big tires on a distant stony driveway, the burble of acceleration. Then a black shape flashed across their view. A big black Jeep, aluminum wheels. A Yukon or a Tahoe, depending on whether it said GMC on the back or Chevrolet. Two guys in it, dark suits. One of them driving and the other slumped back in his seat. Reacher stuck his head all the way out of the window and listened to the sound as it died to silence in the direction of town. Chester Stone waited in his own office suite more than an hour, and then he called downstairs and had the finance director contact the bank and check on the operating account. It showed a $1.1 million credit, wired in 50 minutes ago from the Cayman office of a Bahamas-owned trust company. It's there, the finance guy said. You did the trick, Chief. Stone gripped the phone and wondered exactly what trick he had done. I'm coming down, he said. I want to go over the figures.
The figures are good, the finance guy said. Don't worry about it.
I'm coming down anyway, Stone said. He rode the elevator two floors down and joined the finance guy in his plush inner office, entered the password and called up the secret spreadsheet. Then the finance guy took over and typed in the new balance available in the operating account. The software ran the calculation and came up exactly level, 6 weeks into the future. See? The guy said. Bingo! What about the interest payment? Stone asked.
11 grand a week, 6 weeks, kind of steep, isn't it?
Can we pay it?
The guy nodded confidently. Sure we can. We owe two suppliers 73 grand. We got it ready to go. If we lose the invoices, get them to resubmit, we free that cash up for a spell.
He tapped the screen and indicated a provision against received invoices.
$73,000 minus $11,000 a week for 6 weeks gives us $7,000 to spare. We should go out to dinner a couple of times.
Run it again, okay? Stone said.
Double check.
The guy gave him a look, but he ran it again. He took out the 1.1, ended up in the red, put it back in again, and ended up balanced. He canceled the provision against the invoices, subtracted $11,000 every 7 days, and ended the 6-week period with an operating surplus of $7,000.
Close, he said, but the right side of close.
How do we repay the principal? Stone asked. We need $1.1 million available at the end of the 6 weeks.
No problem, the guy said. I've got it all figured. We'll have it in time.
Show me, okay?
Okay, see here?
He was tapping the screen on a different line where payments due in from customers were listed.
These two wholesalers owe us exactly 1.173, which exactly matches the principal plus the lost invoices, and it's due exactly 6 weeks from now.
Will they pay on time?
The guy shrugged. Well, they always have.
Stone stared at the screen. His eyes moved up and down, left and right.
Run it all again, triple check. Don't sweat it, Chief. It adds up.
Just do it, okay? The guy nodded. It was Stone's company, after all.
He ran it again, the whole calculation, beginning to end, and it came out just the same.
Hobie's 1.1 disappeared as the blizzard of paychecks cleared. The two suppliers went hungry. The interest got paid. The payments came in from the wholesalers. Hobie got his 1.1 back. The suppliers got paid late. And the sheet ended up showing the same trivial $7,000 surplus in their favor.
Don't sweat it, the guy said again. It works out.
Stone was staring at the screen, wondering if that spare $7,000 would buy Marilyn a trip to Europe. Probably not. Not a 6-week trip, anyway. And it would alert her. It would worry her. She'd ask him why he was making her go, and he'd have to tell her. She was very smart, smart enough to get it out of him, one way or another. And then she would refuse to go to Europe, and she would end up lying awake every night for 6 weeks, too. The suitcase was still there, lying on the front lawn. There was a bullet hole punched in one end, no exit hole. The bullet must have gone through the leather, through the sturdy plywood carcass, and burned to a stop against the packed paper inside. Reacher smiled and carried it back to join Jody over at the garage. They left the Jeep on the blacktop apron and went in the same way they had come out. Closed up the roller door and walked through to the breezeway. Locked the inside door behind them with the green key and walked through to the kitchen. Locked that door behind them and stepped past Jody's abandoned garment bag in the hallway. Reacher carried the suitcase into the living room. More space and more light there than in the den. He opened the case and lifted the concertina files out onto the floor. The bullet fell out with them and bounced on the rug. It was a standard 9mm Parabellum, full copper jacket, slightly flattened on the nose from the impact with the old plywood, but otherwise unmarked. The paper had slowed it to a complete stop in the space of about 18 inches. He could see the hole punched all the way through half the files. He weighed the bullet in his palm, and then he saw Jody at the door watching him. He tossed the bullet to her. She caught it, one-handed.
Souvenir, he said.
She juggled it like it was hot and dropped it in the fireplace. Joined him on the rug, kneeling hip to hip beside him in front of the mass of paper. He caught her perfume, something he did not recognize, but something subtle and intensely feminine. The sweatshirt was too big on her, large and shapeless, but somehow it emphasized her figure. The sleeves finished halfway down the backs of her hands, almost at her fingers. Her Levi's were cinched in tight around her tiny waist with a belt, and her legs left them slightly empty. She looked fragile, but he could remember the strength in her arms, thin but wiry. She bent to look at the files, and her hair fell forward, and he caught the same soft smell he recalled from 15 years previously.
What are we looking for? She asked.
He shrugged. We'll know when we find it, I guess. They looked hard, but they found nothing. There was nothing there. Nothing current, nothing significant. just a mass of household paper looking suddenly old and pathetic as it charted its way through a domestic life that was now over. The most recent item was the will, on its own in a separate slot, sealed into an envelope with neat writing on it. Neat, but slightly slow and shaky. The writing of a man just back from the hospital after his first heart attack. Jody took it out to the hallway and slipped it into the pocket of her garment bag. "Any unpaid bills?" she called. There was a slot marked pending. It was empty.
"Can't see any," he called back. "There'll be a few coming in, I guess, right? Do they come in monthly?"
She gave him a look from the doorway and smiled. "Yes, they do," she said. "Monthly, every month."
There was a slot marked medical. It was overstuffed with receipted bills from the hospital and the clinic, and sheaves of efficient correspondence from the insurance provider. Reacher leafed through it all. "Christ, is that what this stuff costs?"
Jody came back and bent to look. "Sure it is," she said. "Have you got insurance?"
He looked at her, blankly. "I think maybe the VA gives it to me, at least for a period."
"You should check it out," she said. "Make sure."
He shrugged. "I feel okay."
"So did Dad," she said, "for 63.5 straight years."
She knelt beside him again, and he saw her eyes cloud over. He laid his hand on her arm gently. "Hell of a day, right?" he said. She nodded and blinked. Then she came up with a small, wry smile.
"Unbelievable," she said. "I bury the old man. I get shot at by a couple of murderers. I break the law by failing to report so many felonies I can't even count them. And then I get talked into hooking up with some wild man aiming to run some kind of a vigilante deal. You know what Dad would have said to me?"
"What?" She pursed her lips and lowered her voice into a close imitation of Garber's good-natured growl.
"All in a day's work, girl. All in a day's work."
"That's what he would have said to me." Reacher grinned back at her and squeezed her arm again. Then he leafed through the medical junk and picked out a letterhead. "Let's go find this clinic," he said. There was a lot of debate going on inside the Tahoe about whether they should go back at all. Failure was not a popular word in Hobie's vocabulary. It might be better just to take off and disappear, just get the hell out. It was an attractive prospect, but they were pretty sure Hobie would find them. Maybe not soon, but he would find them. And that was not an attractive prospect. So they turned their attention to damage limitation. It was clear what they had to do. They made the necessary stops and wasted a plausible amount of time in a diner just off the southbound side of Route 9. By the time they had battled the traffic back down to the southern tip of Manhattan, they had their whole story straight. "It was a no-brainer," the first guy said. "We waited for hours, which is why we're so late back. Problem was, there was a whole bunch of soldiers there, kind of ceremonial, but they had rifles all over the place."
"How many?"
Hobie asked.
"Soldiers?" the second guy said. "At least a dozen, maybe 15. They were milling around, so it was hard to count them exactly. Some kind of honor guard."
"She left with them," the first guy said. "They must have escorted her down from the cemetery, and then she went back somewhere with them afterward."
"You didn't think to follow?"
"No way we could," the second guy said. "They were driving slow, a long line of cars, like a funeral procession. They'd have made us in a second. We couldn't just tag on the end of a funeral procession, right?"
"What about the big guy from the Keys?"
"He left real early. We just let him go. We were watching for Mrs. Jacob. It was pretty clear by then which one she was. She stayed around, then she left, all surrounded by this bunch of military."
"So what did you do then?"
"We checked the house," the first guy said. "Locked up tight. So we went into the town and checked the property title. Everything's listed in the public library. The place was registered to a guy called Leon Garber. We asked the librarian what she knew, and she just handed us the local newspaper. Page 3, there was a story about the guy. Just died, heart trouble. Widower. Only surviving relative is his daughter, Jody, the former Mrs. Jacob, who is a young but very eminent financial attorney with Spencer, Gutman, Ricca, and Talbot of Wall Street, and who lives on Lower Broadway right here in New York City." Hobie nodded slowly, and tapped the sharp end of his hook on the desk with a jittery little rhythm.
"And who was this Leon Garber exactly? Why all the soldiers at his wake?"
"Military policeman," the first guy said. The second guy nodded.
"Mustered out with 3 stars and more medals than you can count. Served 40 years, Korea, Vietnam, everywhere."
Hobie stopped tapping. He sat still and the color drained out of his face, leaving his skin dead white, all except for the shiny pink burn scars that glowed vivid in the gloom.
"Military policeman,"
he repeated quietly. He sat for a long time with those words on his lips. He just sat and stared into space. And then he lifted his hook off the desk and rotated it in front of his eyes, slowly examining it, allowing the thin beams of light from the blinds to catch its curves and contours. It was trembling, so he took it in his left hand and held it still.
"Military policeman,"
he said again, staring at the hook. Then he transferred his gaze to the 2 men on the sofas.
"Leave the room,"
he said to the second guy. The guy glanced once at his partner and went out and closed the door softly behind him. Hobie pushed back in his chair and stood up, came out from behind the desk and stepped over and stopped still directly behind the first guy, who just sat there on his sofa, not moving, not daring to turn around and look. He wore a size 16 collar, which made his neck a fraction over 5 inches in diameter, assuming a human neck is more or less a uniform cylinder, which was an approximation Hobie had always been happy to make. Hobie's hook was a simple steel curve, like a capital letter J, generously sized. The inside diameter of the curve was 4¾ inches. He moved fast, darting the hook out and forcing it over the guy's throat from behind. He stepped back and pulled with all his strength. The guy threw himself upward and backward, his fingers scrabbling under the cold metal to relieve the gagging pressure. Hobie smiled and pulled harder. The hook was riveted to a heavy leather cup in a matching-shaped corset, the cup over the remains of his forearm, the corset buckled tight over his bicep above his elbow. The forearm assembly was just a stabilizer. It was the upper corset, smaller than the bulge of his elbow joint, that took all the strain and made it impossible for the hook to be separated from the stump. He pulled until the gagging turned to fractured wheezing, and the redness in the guy's face began to turn blue. Then he eased off an inch and bent close to the guy's ear.
"He had a big bruise on his face. What the hell was that about?"
The guy was wheezing and gesturing wildly. Hobie twisted the hook, which relieved the pressure on the guy's voice box, but brought the tip up into the soft area under his ear.
"What the hell was that about?"
he asked again. The guy knew that with the hook at that angle, any extra rearward pressure was going to put the tip right through his skin, into that vulnerable triangle behind the jaw. He didn't know much about anatomy, but he knew he was a half inch away from dying.
"I'll tell you," he wheezed. "I'll tell you."
Hobie kept the hook in position, twisting it every time the guy hesitated, so the whole true story took no longer than 3 minutes, beginning to end.
"You failed me," Hobie said.
"Yes, we did,"
the guy gasped.
"But it was his fault. He got all tangled up behind the screen door. He was useless."
Hobie jerked the hook.
"As opposed to what? Like he's useless and you're useful?"
"It was his fault,"
the guy gasped again.
"I'm still useful."
"You're going to have to prove that to me."
"How?"
the guy wheezed.
"Please, how? Just tell me."
"Easy. You can do something for me."
"Yes,"
the guy gasped.
"Yes, anything, please."
"Bring me Mrs. Jacob,"
Hobie screamed at him.
"Yes,"
the guy screamed back.
"And don't screw up again,"
Hobie screamed.
"No,"
the guy gasped.
"No, we won't, I promise."
Hobie jerked the hook again, twice, in time with his words.
"Not we, just
you, because you can do something else for me.
What?
The guy wheezed.
Yes, what, anything?
Get rid of your useless partner,
Hobie whispered.